For over 30 years, Kingston Community House has provided low-cost meeting space for hundreds of groups, allowing people to come together to learn from one another, share resources, and trade skills. As it becomes safe once again to gather in person, we look forward to providing the Kingston community with a comfortable and convenient place to reconnect with one another. Located in downtown Kingston, we operate 7 days a week. For more information on Kingston Community House and how to book, please visit kingstoncommunityhouse.org.
Hey everyone, this is Joseph Guido. I am CFRC's Airwave YGK Musicians in Residence Project Intern. Do you love local music and supporting local arts? CFRC's annual funding drive is running until December 31st, and your gift is needed to help us provide local musicians with modern, top-of-the-line equipment, space, and technical support to better showcase their creativity on our airwaves all year round. Help us raise $25,000 this year. Make your gift today via cfrc.ca.
Hello and happy holidays. You are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Many of our programmers are away for the holidays, so today we're presenting music from the local choral society, Cantabile Choirs, for you to enjoy. In this special broadcast, we'll listen to selections from the Cantabile Choirs album, What Sweeter Music, a cappella works of Mark Sirott, performed by Cantabile Pro Coro and featuring soprano vocalist Mirielle Asseline. Together we'll enjoy As a Tree, O Earth Loving Mother, Ecce Concipies, Belulalo, Bercusa Cadien, A Child and Ubi Caritas. Sit back with a hot cup of tea or some eggnog and enjoy the program. From all of us at CFRC 101.9 FM, have a safe, happy holiday and best wishes for an amazing 2024.
Yeah. Oh. CFRC listeners, this is Christina Laurie, CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative news reporter. CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st, and you can help CFRC keep our listeners informed on issues that matter with modernized broadcasting equipment and trained team members. Help CFRC hit our $25,000 fundraising goal this year by donating today at cfrc.ca.
Yes, I'd like a bowl of hot alphabet soup.
Hi, my name is Hayden, and I have a new show on CFRC called Alphabet Soup.
A bowl of hot?
Make sure it's hot.
Alphabet Soup is a musical variety show that's live every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m.
Make sure it's hot.
Right.
Okay, sir. Coming right up.
Tune in to hear something classic or something fresh, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. on CFRC.
Hey, Charlie, table 26 wants a hot alphabet soup.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
Hey, I'm Julian Taylor, and I'm excited that my radio show, The Jukebox, can now be heard on CFRC 101.9 FM out of Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. The show is all-inclusive. I only play music that I love and think that you'll love too. So tune in every Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to noon right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
This is CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus and community radio station, broadcast from the basement of Caruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston. You can also hear this program locally on Cogeco Cable, channel 282, and is streamed online at cfrc.ca. Welcome to Biotech Beat. This is your host, Krishna. Today we will hear a talk on the topic Managing the World's Most Prevalent Health Emergencies by Mike Rion, Executive Director, World Health Organization Emergency Program. This program was produced and distributed by the Institute of International and European Affairs. Before that, we have a few messages.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program is planting seedlings across five regions of the country: BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They plant in areas that are in need of reforestation or afforestation across Canada. Tree Canada selects sites where appropriate native species will be planted to make sure that natural forests come back to life. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband Tom and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it. So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
CFRC is active on every social media platform. Check us out at CFRC Radio on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. And on Twitter at CFRC.
YouTube. Mike, can you give us some sense of what are the really most urgent issues on your desk today at the end of 2024?
Yes. I was checking this morning about the number of events we're tracking around the world. I think it was 367 as of this morning, but we have 41 graded emergencies, and they're emergencies that require, by our grading system, a formal WHO response. In other words, boots on the ground, WHO responding with partners. And they will range from what we see today in Syria, which is a massive displacement of people. And while we're very joyous for the people of Syria, maybe having a chance at a more stable and peaceful future, the reality is that there are millions of people displaced now all across Syria. There are refugees returning from other countries. There are still hotly contested areas in which civilians are moving through. We've seen many attacks on healthcare over the last 6-7 days. So that's at one end of the scale. At the other end of the scale, we're investigating a very, very severe cluster of unexplained deaths, mainly amongst children in southern DR Congo, where the zone of the suspected epidemic is 2 full days where we'll drive away from the nearest airfield. So on the one hand, investigating, you know, a potentially very serious epidemic disease, and on the other hand, responding to a rapidly unfolding humanitarian crisis, and pretty much everything in between.
Thanks, Mike. When you have a situation like Syria, which was certainly unpredictable in its speed, how does the WHO even begin to scale up in that context?
A good question. I think, first of all, for us as the World Health Organization, we're there before, during, and after crisis, because we have a relationship with our member states. So we've always been in Syria, so we always have had a presence. We've operated on a whole of Syria basis over the last 10 or more years, in which we see Syria as one zone. We've operated both from Damascus and Gaziantep in Turkey, supporting the people affected in northwest Syria and the people affected in greater Syria from 2 zones of operation. That's worked for us up to now. Scaling that up now, and the needs have definitely scaled up. We'll have to surge staff in from outside. We will have to enhance the capability of our partners and try and get our partners to deploy on the ground in the health cluster. So part of it will be direct surge. Part of it will be asking our partners to scale up at the same time. And then really investing in the local system. I mean, the one thing that Syria does have, and many countries have, is an inherently competent medical, nursing, and other systems. Very often, people have become disconnected from the system. Infrastructure has been damaged. But many countries, particularly in the Middle East, have proud historically strong health services. What has happened is those health services have been hugely disrupted by conflict, by displacement, and by direct attacks on healthcare. So a lot of our work is to recreate the infrastructure in which people can return, where the salaries can be paid. So the solutions aren't external, in as much as they are the external entities have to create the conditions in which local health staff can return to work, in which the local system can start to reignite and re-engage local services. And that's the hard part, because it's very easy to look at an external solution where everyone arrives with help and we have all the flags flying, and that's great for the first few weeks, it's great for the first few months, but that doesn't last forever. So you really have to switch as quickly as you can into a recovery phase where you can start to rebuild the existing inherent health service. And that link between the humanitarian response and the development response, which some people call a nexus between the two, is one area that's really not functioning as well as it needs to function globally. The humanitarians are exhausted. They're exhausted responding. Our development partners are obviously very nervous about getting involved in humanitarian and conflict situations in which it's very difficult to do sustainable development work. But unfortunately, there are so many countries right now affected by fragility, conflict, and vulnerability around the world. And we were working, doing some work with the UN Ops people, looking at how many people will live in contexts of fragility, conflict, and vulnerability by 2030. And, you know, it will be 85% of the world's poorest people. You know, half the children who die under five will die in those settings. 60-65%, two-thirds of women who die in childbirth will die in those settings. Half the under-five mortality will occur in those settings. We think 60-70% of high-impact epidemics will occur in those settings. So these contexts of chronic fragility, conflict, vulnerability, where sort of the three C's of climate, contagion, and conflict are just intertwined. And I think Michael used a good word, interlocking crises. And I think that's the context we're looking at. A whole series of countries that seem to be separating from the rest of the world. Many, many countries that were otherwise known as developing are moving on in their development cycle. They're making gains in education. They're making gains in health. Maybe their political systems are not what the West would approve of or whatever it might be. But the reality is many, many countries are making progress in those basic metrics. It's those countries that seem to be just separated politically, socially, economically, religiously, and are being driven by this constant repeated crisis. And we have to do something about that, because that's driving displacement, that's driving migration, that's driving desperation. The people moving up through the Americas or people moving across the Mediterranean aren't doing it because they want to risk drowning in the Mediterranean. They're doing it because they're desperate. They're moving away from something that cannot sustain them or their families. And they're doing that for a reason. They're not risking their lives for no reason. So unless we deal with those drivers, then it will become and continue to become a major driver of not only instability in these countries in the coming months and years, but a major driver of instability in so-called stable states.
Just turning to the last time we spoke, it was exactly 2 years ago, and there was also in the Development Irish Aid lecture series, and the topic was then COVID. And in fact, it was the Omicron variant, if my memory is correct. What I want to ask you is, we all know COVID hasn't gone away, but what progress has been made in the WHO in dealing with the next great pandemic? Where are the negotiations at with the pandemic agreement? Do you expect it to be adopted in 2025? Is it important that it be adopted in 2025? And if not, if it isn't going to be adopted, then what are the problems?
That's a good question. I mean, the idea of having a strong pandemic agreement or accord underpins everything we need to do to get ready for the next pandemic. A piece of paper or an agreement or a piece of international legislation by itself doesn't change the world. But what it does is provide the basis, provides the solid agreement between member states on what we need to do. And actually, member states have made remarkable progress. I mean, yes, it's been reported how difficult it is, and it is difficult. These are important matters. You led 20 years ago the negotiations on revising the international health regulations, which haven't been done in decades. And that revised IHR has underpinned our global surveillance, verification, risk assessment work, and our cooperation with member states on infectious diseases for two decades. And it's just been revised again. You went through that. You know what it takes to get 194 countries to agree on anything is tough. So there are a lot of issues, and there are issues in there around sovereignty. There are issues in there around intellectual property, around access and benefit sharing, around equity, around a lot of different things that are important in both North and South. So there are issues that need to be resolved. But I think they've made remarkable progress. For example, effectively, if you think about it, and you know, the audience may not know this as well, but the world of diplomacy seems to thrive on green text. You know, you have the green text that's been greened inside the actual draft document. And it's remarkable, a lot of work. There's the articles on research are green. The article on health workforce is green. There are articles on supply chain that are almost green. So there are key areas where we need to work together on ensuring we have a scalable workforce in the future, ensuring we've got strong collaborative surveillance, and ensuring we've got good community protection, on ensuring that we have countermeasures available to everyone. Those key elements of the agreement are in place. There are some specific issues that do need to be resolved, especially around the access and benefit sharing system. There are some issues around intellectual property. There are some issues about how detailed should the treaty be around issues of prevention and issues of risk reduction for the emergence of epidemics. And the 12th meeting of the IMB took place last week. I think we're reasonably pleased with their progress. The prospect next year is very good. In the normal sort of geopolitical environment, you would imagine that the countries are approaching consensus. You know, it's never there until it's there, but they are approaching consensus. But the world is a bit fractured right now geopolitically, so it's very hard to predict. There are question marks over multilateral systems, you know, this nationalism versus multilateralism. And the reality for me is that the greatest definition of your sovereignty as a nation is your ability to engage with other nations confidently on matters of common interest. We do it in trade. We do it, we trust each other. We wouldn't be able to move or trade unless we had agreements on how to do that. Well, if we can't agree on what to do for the next pandemic, then that is a real tragedy for the planet. It's a tragedy for you, for the next generation. We need to have the basic rules of the game in place. It won't be perfect. Nothing ever is. But without such an agreement, we are going to go into the next pandemic with no playbook. And that is not a good idea.
Well, the glass is either half full or half empty, but I suppose the missing ingredient is always political will, and hopefully the political will is there because, as we all know, disease doesn't stop at borders. Can I look at one of the unknown unknowns, as it were, to quote or misquote a US statesman? How important is strong cooperation from the new incoming US administration, the conclusion of the pandemic agreement?
I think strong, well, first and foremost, throughout the whole process of negotiating the pandemic agreement thus far, I must say that all countries have remained very, very constructive in the process, and particularly the US has been very constructive, very direct, very sure of its position, very clear and honest around the red lines and areas where they want to see convergence, or they want to see a certain direction. So I've been very pleased with the way in which the USG has engaged in the pandemic agreement. It, again, will come down to each and every sovereign state when a final agreement text is put to the member states at the World Health Assembly. It will be up to each member state to decide whether or not it's willing to adopt the agreement and then engage in a conference of the parties and decide what further work will need to be done. Because at the end of the day, a pandemic agreement is a very short document. It is essentially a series of aspirations and promises to do other things, like build a strong system for access and benefits, to build a strong mechanism for training workforce, to build a strong supply chain for the future. The very act of writing an agreement doesn't make those things real. What it does is provides a blueprint for that. And I'm sure from for example, the US's perspective, we rely heavily on the United States for a tremendous amount of technical cooperation, scientific cooperation. In exchange for all of that, we at WHO provide to all member states the kind of intelligence, like today, the reason why if we're talking about the outbreak investigations we have around the world, we're putting them on our secure website for our member states. They can see exactly what we see going on around the world, be it in the jungles of southern Congo to what's happening in Syria. So our ability to gather and add value to public health intelligence, to be on the ground as eyes and ears, to respond and put out fires before they become out of control, These are things I think we share those values with the US. I think in general, the pandemic agreement adds to the body of law in this area, mainly as represented by the international health regulations. I think all sort of reasonable thinking people would see that. The question is, where does the consensus lie? How far does the agreement go? Is it going too far for some, not far enough for others? And that's going to be the balance. I'm confident that when we look at issues of global security, there are other areas where it's harder for us to agree on certain things. But when it comes to the idea of how do we ensure our global health security, then I do believe the vast majority of member states agree that there really is only one platform to do that through comprehensively, and that's through the World Health Organization as a specialized agency of the United Nations. There's lots of speculation, Mary, around the US. This, what will the US do, what it won't do? What I know is I've worked for 25, 30 years in the front line. I've stood in the trenches with many American colleagues there and many American institutions. We need the US to really work and assure that we have a strong global health protection architecture, that the global health emergency architecture is strong. If one of those key partners is not there, that makes it weaker. There's no question. If that partner is not there, we have to get on with that and cut our cloth. But the world is a much safer place with a strong United States supporting things like the pandemic agreement, supporting the international health regulations, supporting global health security. And I hope, I fervently hope that they will continue to do that in 2025.
Mike, I just want to reference one specific crisis, and that is the conflict in Sudan. What exactly, could you give us an update on what is happening there? And what the main concerns you would have are in that area?
Yeah, I mean, it's terrible. Sudan is the forgotten crisis of any. I mean, it's been entirely overshadowed. And not, I mean, what's happened in Ukraine, what's happened in Palestine, what's happening in Syria are all very important and deserve their appropriate attention. But what's happened in Sudan has essentially escaped the true attention of the world. We need to keep it in global spotlight. And thank you so much, Mary, for raising that specific area, that geography, because the security situation is highly volatile there. There are huge issues on bureaucratic administrative delays and working in the country. There's frequent denials for access to key areas. We have lots of other things happening beyond the conflict. We have heavy rains and flooding, damaging roads, reduced access because of that. So it's not just a conflict crisis. We've got droughts in some parts, flooding in another part. Again, a poster child for that climate contagion and conflict issue. We've got various outbreaks. I could start in naming the different epidemics that we're tracking. And then you've got this real big problem of protection of health workers, attacks on healthcare, and really, and this is the same across many conflicts, the fact that we have so many attacks on healthcare, either on healthcare infrastructure, healthcare personnel, healthcare transport, like ambulances, that it's becoming the fact that so many are doing this with total impunity. I'm not aware of a single person, institution, country, or anybody who's ever been held to account for attacking healthcare, ever. And since we've been doing this for a number of years now, but since 2000, over the last 5 years, we've well over 5,000 documented verified attacks on healthcare. So this is really happening very much in Sudan too. We've had 65 attacks on healthcare this year, resulting in 167 deaths and 95 injuries. That's in the healthcare facilities, right? That's not outside. So it'll give you an idea of the extent to which all of this is happening. The other huge concern, I mean, obviously, nutrition has been a major concern. We've been at near famine status for so long. It's incredible. The resilience of the Sudanese people is beyond measure. Gender-based violence, sexualized violence is rampant and something, again, that's not triggering the international community, in my view, in the way it should be. I think if you want to look at a given crisis in the world for depth and breadth in terms of geography, population affected, in terms of the intensity of the crisis, the number of different types of crises that are happening at one time, Sudan is where it's at. And yes, it's got the least attention the least attention. Even today, it's got the least political attention to find solutions. And there are many countries involved, you know, in, I would call it, in the proxy efforts, supporting one side, supporting the other side. A lot of manipulation going on geopolitically in the process as well. So when you're humanitarians or local NGOs or you're the local health system, trying to exist and survive in that situation, it's incredibly difficult to do that. The distances in Sudan are huge. The population is massive. The displacement is huge as well. And it's almost a problem that it's too hard to get your head around at times. It's so big. And yet it's not getting the attention it needs. Ireland is doing that, I know. But others need to step up and step in, because I don't see a greater humanitarian crisis on the planet right now. Even the crisis in Syria, while it may be very severe and there's a lot of population movement, in terms of human impact right now, there is no greater crisis on this planet than what's happening with Sudan.
Is this failure to focus on Sudan or do anything, is this partly reflecting the vacuum that's there at the Security Council, that there is no overseeing body with the authority to say, let's get serious about this problem?
Well, I'll leave that now to you and Michael, the real diplomats, to sort out, right? But
I think you just answered the question. But before going over...
It's exactly the same thing when it comes to attacks on healthcare. You know, the reality is that the humanitarians are out there doing their work. We will continue to do our work. It's not our job to be political. But it is the job of the political architecture of the United Nations to create the space in which humanitarian assistance can be delivered and to create the space in which recovery can occur and populations can have their peace, stability, health and education returned. By any measure, the system, the Security Council system, is not delivering on that. Now, it was always a difficult task. Was never easy. Sitting in and trying to get countries who are otherwise geopolitically or ideologically at odds with each other to work together is not easy. It was never an easy job. But whether the job itself is getting more difficult or whether we're getting worse at doing the job, I leave it to you to work out.
Thank you, Mike. I'd like to encourage the audience to put in some questions. I can't see them myself yet. But before giving the floor to those joining us online, there's one final question I want to ask, and it's a question with two parts. The first part is that the World Health Summit in 2024 had as its main theme, building trust for a healthier world. Is there a problem in the global south in this area? That's the first question. And then the question of trust in science, trust in vaccines. Is there a problem in the global north in that area? How do you see the issue of trust as it affects your work?
I think there are major issues of trust across the board, but I don't think it's a north-south thing. I think there are nuances with north and south. It's hard to speak about it in that terms. But in general... I can see it in terms of equity, there is a breakdown in trust. I think in general, and you're saying this in a very generalized way, the countries of the South and Wasanovas of the South felt that certainly during the pandemic, they did not get a fair share of access to the countermeasures that were coming online and being available. And that's created a sense of a two-tier system. There's a system for the North and a system for the South. And that feeds into similar experiences during HIV/AIDS, where again, the availability of countermeasures was years, decades sometimes behind. Now, in this particular case, equity came later, but maybe quicker than it did previously. That's why I think for the pandemic agreement, there's a real feeling amongst countries of the South that they want something they can trust. They want an agreement that lays things out in a way that they can trust that equity will be addressed systematically in any future pandemic. And that will be the trust issue north-south at the macro level when it comes to that. There's also a trust issue when it comes to climate and other things. I mean, this idea that in some ways by 2030, if we don't keep the temperatures down below 1.5 degree increase, we're going to have some consequences of climate. I mean, that's rubbish. The fact is there are hundreds of millions of people in the Sahel and the Horn of Africa and in other places, in Mozambique and other places, that are literally suffering the massive impacts of climate now. They have the droughts, they have the floods. It's way beyond what anyone expects. They are living the climate nightmare already. And again, the trust issue is when we have green climate funds and all kinds of funds, and we see the spectacle of the negotiations that happened most recently in Azerbaijan, where we're, you know, fighting over what will be mitigation funds for developing countries. It's hard for them to actually trust when there's such a nickel and diming going on funding. So I do think there's a trust issue in general around things like that. Is the North actually serious about assisting the South on real issues that are existentially affecting the ability of the global South to get out of humanitarian crisis, to deal with the climate crisis, to engage and sort of ignite their development, or at least accelerate their development in the right direction? I think that's a big trust issue right now. In terms of trust in science and vaccination, I think that's universal. I don't think that's a North-South issue. I think that's happening everywhere on the planet. There are different drivers of that. It's really worrying. It's really upsetting, quite frankly. For example, vaccination has saved more lives on this planet than every doctor put together with every nurse, put together with every hospital, put together with every CAT scan, and every surgical procedure we could ever do. Hundreds of millions of lives saved by vaccines. Simply the most effective health intervention that's ever been designed by humans. That's a reality. Now, that doesn't mean that those interventions don't need to be carefully monitored, properly regulated, always safe, always tested. That's the process. What's happened is that the question marks over the safety of these, the conspiracies around why these things are produced, why they're being used, have really entered the mainstream. They were always there. And quite honestly, Mary, if I'm a parent, or even for myself, I'm going to question anything I put in my child's body, drug or vaccine. Healthy skepticism, hesitancy is not a bad thing. To hesitate before you make an important decision is not bad. It's not, as long as that hesitation is then followed by questioning and gathering of information, good information that allows someone to make a good decision. So I think I think public health and science, and we in policy and public services have left a vacuum into which